Our speaker today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor of the Deseret News, John Hughes. A former editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Mr. Hughes has also served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, as Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, and as Chair of Presidential and Congressional Commissions on International Broadcasting. Immediately before being appointed editor of the Deseret News, he was professor of journalism and director of the International Media Studies Program in the Department of Communications here at BYU, a position from which he still considers himself on leave and to which he plans to eventually return. Born in Wales, educated in England, Mr. Hughes served for 6 years as the Christian Science Monitor's Africa correspondent and for 6 years as the Far East correspondent, before serving for 6 years as the paper's editor and then 3 more years as both editor and publisher of the Christian Science Monitor. Mr. Hughes won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Indonesia, the Overseas Press Club Award for an investigation into international narcotics trafficking, and he was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. He is also a former president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. During the Reagan administration, he served successively as Associate Director of the United States Information Agency, Director of Voice of America, and State Department Spokesman and Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs. On leave from BYU in 1995, he served a 1-year term as Assistant Secretary General and Director of Communications at the United Nations. Mr. Hughes has honorary doctorates from Colby College in Maine and Southern Utah University. He is the author of 2 books, The Indonesian Upheaval and The New Face of Africa. He also writes a nationally syndicated column for the Christian Science Monitor. Long a friend of Mormons and the LDS Church, Professor Hughes may be forgiven his naivete when President Gordon B. Hinckley personally phoned John to ask him to take the position as editor of the Deseret News. John explained that he had just returned from a year's leave to the United Nations, and he wasn't sure that BYU would let him take another leave immediately. President Hinckley replied, "Oh, I think I still have a little influence down there." Mr. Hughes is here today with his lovely wife, Peggy, who is herself a journalist and a graduate of our department. It is truly my pleasure today to introduce to you a most respected international journalist and public servant and a friend and colleague, Mr. John Hughes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. That is a true story about President Hinckley. I can confirm it. It's a particular pleasure for me to be back on the campus of Brigham Young University, a university which I believe to be a special place with a special mission, and I'm sure you all realize how fortunate you are to be here. I spent, as Laurie Wilson said, 5 happy years here as a professor of journalism in the Department of Communications before becoming editor of the Deseret News in January of last year. The Deseret News is owned by the LDS Church. It's got a long and proud tradition. It was the Mountain West's first newspaper, established in 1850, so it's almost 150 years old. Traditionally, its editors have been distinguished journalists who were also members of the LDS Church. When President Hinckley discussed with me, a non-Mormon, the Deseret News assignment, he told me, "You've lived among us. You understand us. We trust you." That was a statement that I found very moving, and it's a trust that I take very seriously. President Hinckley was probably aware that if I mess up, I have to account not only to him, but to my wife Peggy, who, as Laurie said, got her undergraduate and graduate degrees in print and television journalism from BYU, and who's an active member of the LDS Church. Now, some universities have trimmed back their communications departments, arguing that in times of budgetary austerity, they are peripheral. This is an astonishing mistake, and I'm glad that BYU is not making it. As we approach the 21st century, we're in the midst of a communications revolution that affects us all, whatever the direction of our studies, and whatever professions we might follow. BYU needs to be ahead of this revolutionary wave. President Hinckley has said BYU has the opportunity to be the world leader in the training and example of good communications. I attach great weight to his words. After all, anybody who can turn Mike Wallace, the journalistic attack dog of 60 Minutes, into a pussycat, and then have Larry King for dessert, must know something about communications. I believe that the press today is confronted by two major challenges. One is the rapid pace of technological change. The other is the erosion of journalistic ethics. Let me talk about the technological change first, which I'll illustrate with a little anecdote. I was born in a little Welsh town called Neath. My father was born there before me. And although this may seem incredible to you, when my father was a young man, there was not a single automobile in the little town of Neath. He and his brother rode the family horse about 30 miles away to the city of Cardiff, the big city of Cardiff, where they bought the town's, or what would be his town's, first car. They traded the horse for it, but the early cars were unreliable. On the way home, it broke down. So they trudged back to Cardiff, they borrowed back the horse, and they used it to tow the car home. That's how the first car came to the little Welsh town of Neath, albeit not under its own power. Well, what a change we've seen in one generation, from the first car in town to a world of jet planes and spaceships and satellites and the internet. I don't think we can really comprehend the changes that technology will bring to you in the span of your lives. No industry has felt the impact of this technological change more significantly than the communications industry. The way we gather and disseminate information has been changed. When I began my career in journalism, we used to write our stories on something called a typewriter. When I taught at BYU, I had to explain to some of my students what that actually was. Our copy went on paper to the editing desks where editors scribbled changes and corrections on it with pencils. Then the edited stories went out to the newspaper's composing room full of clattering linotype machines. Here, operators re-keyboarded the text, punching letters into molten lead slugs line by line that eventually made up a column of type. The type was transformed by an unwieldy process into the cylinders that got locked onto the press and which finally produced a printed newspaper. Photographers would have to shoot pictures at the scene of a news event, travel back to head office, develop film, make prints, and then convert the prints for printing on the press. Today, reporters simply type their stories on laptop computers from wherever they are, and they transmit their stories electronically and instantly to their home offices. At the Deseret News, our photographers use digital cameras that require no film whatsoever. As long as a phone line is handy, they can transmit the images instantly back to the computers in the Deseret News photo department. This means we can get photo coverage from anywhere in Utah, or indeed anywhere in the world, right on deadline. It's how we transmitted photos from our news team at the Winter Olympic Games in Nagano, the digital images traversing the world, cutting across time zones in seconds. Today, there are no clattering linotype machines, although we do keep a silent old one in a little museum at the Deseret News so people can see how it looked. Today, stories and photos move from computer to computer, undergoing the editing process, getting headlines written, and flowing into page makeup ready for printing. Type sizes can be expanded or contracted, column widths changed, cuts and trims made, late inserts flowed in with the touch of a computer button. If a newspaper has remote printing plants, the pages of the newspaper are no longer transmitted by a courier on a motorcycle, but by satellite up to the stratosphere and back in seconds. In television news, too, the new technology has made for instant coverage of major events around the world and even in space. The world is wired for sound and pretty much for pictures. When big news breaks, we expect to see it live on TV, and most of the time we do. CNN has transformed our lives. It has done so in a remarkably short space of time. About a dozen years ago, I'd made a temporary detour from journalism and was serving as State Department spokesman. One of my duties was to decide which news organizations got the limited number of seats aboard the Secretary of State's plane when we traveled abroad. Though I used to put NBC and CBS and ABC on the plane, I at that time, and this was just about 9-10 years ago, dismissed CNN as a fledgling news organization with a limited audience that would probably never amount to much. As a matter of fact, CNN was so upset with me that on one occasion they went to court to get an injunction to stop the plane leaving. They lost that fight then, but look what influence CNN has achieved today. Presidents watch it to find out what's going on in Iraq. Governments sometimes act. Generals move their troops. Corporate chieftains sometimes make major business decisions on the basis of what they see on CNN. Because news is now transmitted instantly, the consequences of getting it wrong are more serious. The responsibility for getting it right is much greater. Of the war in Vietnam, it used to be said that it was the first conflict that brought the horrors of war into American living rooms, and that was true. But there was a time lapse. Combat footage shot in Da Nang or Hue had to be ferried back by plane and helicopter to Saigon. From there, it was shipped by air to Bangkok or Hong Kong. Satellite time was still, in those days, inordinately expensive. So unless the film was extremely dramatic, it was shipped by air to New York for developing and viewing. And so several days elapsed during which there was time for reflection and editing before the footage actually appeared on television screens. By the advent of the Gulf War, technology had changed all this. Correspondents using relatively portable transmitting equipment were able to broadcast from the middle of the desert live and appear instantly on American television screens. Thus, we saw a network correspondent reporting that Scud missiles, reportedly carrying chemical agents in their warheads, were incoming. The initial report was false. They were Scud missiles, but not with chemical warheads. By the time the erroneous information was corrected, millions of viewers might have missed it. We can't turn the clock back, and we shouldn't. The new technology makes many miracles possible, but the role of the reporter and the editor is even more critical in the rush to publish or broadcast. And this brings me to the second challenge confronting journalists today, the need to stem the erosion of ethics. Now, please don't understand me. Across the United States today, there are thousands of conscientious journalists, sometimes overworked, often underpaid, of course none of them here actually covering this are underpaid, providing comprehensive coverage of city, state, and federal governments, covering business, reporting community news, and all the other minutiae that intelligent citizens need to conduct their affairs. I do think that Utah is fortunate to have newspapers that are generally responsible and serious. The press can be a significant force for good. But there are also lapses from professional journalistic standards that are disturbing. Some years ago, I sat on the Pulitzer Prize board that awarded a Pulitzer Prize to a Washington Post reporter, Janet Cook. It was a moving story about a child crack dealer. It read beautifully. It seemed well documented. We got an impassioned plea on its behalf by a minority member of the board who said that we white middle-class editors didn't understand the world of the ghetto in America's big cities. So we gave Janet Cook the prize. There was just one thing wrong with the story. The child crack dealer she wrote about didn't exist. She had made the story up, and when her editors became suspicious about it, she could not take them to the location or produce the young crack dealer. Honorably, the Washington Post returned the Pulitzer Prize and withdrew the nomination. You would think that such a scandal would put a serious crimp in journalistic invention and plagiarism, but alas, such transgressions are still with us. I am sorry to say that a journalism professor at Boston University plagiarized material from another writer in a commencement address. More astonishing, a report on this whole affair in the Boston Globe was then plagiarized by a New York Times reporter. Manipulation of the news is a problem and an embarrassment to journalists of integrity. You may remember NBC's account of unsafe GMC trucks. The fuel trunks were so built that they were said to be in danger of exploding if they were hit in certain accidents. NBC reenacted some of the crashes for television, but they couldn't get the tanks to explode. So what did they do? They attached little rockets to them to create dramatic visual effect. In another perversion of the truth, network cameras displayed footage of dead fish in Idaho, reputedly killed by some environmental disaster. Only trouble was, the fish weren't really dead. They had been stunned to provide the shot that the cameras needed. All too often, we have instances of tasteless intrusiveness. The cameramen up a tree, shooting through windows, the families of hostages who have pleaded for privacy. The TV reporter who holds a microphone in the face of an 11-year-old AIDS victim and asks him how he feels knowing that he's going to die. There is journalistic arrogance that causes even so mild a mannered journalist as Jim Lehrer of the Lehrer NewsHour on PBS, which also airs on KBYU-TV, to explode in anger, as he did at a commencement address a few years ago. Among some journalists, he said, quote, "There is a stench of contempt in the approach and the words, in the sneer, in the body language, and the message is there for all to see. Only the journalists of America are smart enough to know what to do in Bosnia, in the economy, in health care, and Supreme Court appointments. Don't believe politicians, government officials, or any other people when they say they're doing something. They never tell the truth. We, the journalists, are experts in motives because ours are so pure." That's the end of Mr. Lehrer's quote. He said in conclusion that this kind of arrogance is a plague on and in the newsrooms of America. Unless something is done about it, he said, the credibility of journalists will continue to erode with you who read and watch and listen to what journalists say. It's against this background that we come to the reporting on one of the most tragic and disturbing scandals of our times, the President Clinton-Monica Lewinsky affair. And I want to make it clear where I stand. I do not accept the view that the private lives of public figures are off limits to reasonable scrutiny by the press. That's the price that must be paid by those who seek our votes, demand our trust, and make significant decisions, even to the point of peace or war, on our behalf. I do believe that this scrutiny by the press must be reasonable and purposeful, not merely prurient. Parenthetically, let me say that the Deseret News has been challenged as rarely before in deciding how to report for its readers this sordid saga. The stories produce sexual detail and language that ordinarily would have no place in a family newspaper. For many months, we have had to decide on a daily basis how much to publish, how to edit it, and what kind of prominence to give it in the newspaper. But significant issues are at stake. A presidency is in peril. And so we've tried to give our readers the facts they need to come to conclusions without assaulting them with offensive graphic detail. Within this framework, I don't question the press's responsibility to chronicle the Clinton-Lewinsky story. I do, however, think that journalists ought to be asking some questions of themselves about the care they have taken in pursuit of the truth. Especially in the early days of the coverage, some very prestigious news organizations made mistakes and were obliged to make retractions. There was questionable use of unattributed quotes. There was overuse of anonymous sources. We didn't know enough about the location and the credibility of some of those anonymous sources. Who were they? Where were they working? Why were they telling us these things? In due course, there came a wave of journalistic self-examination. Journalists realized the enormity of their responsibility in working a story that could cause the downfall of a president of the United States. So steadier hands took over on the editing desks, especially in TV news. I think that the internet contributed to the early problems. Anybody can get on it, pretend to be a journalist, and publish a scurrilous rumor. I like very much the New Yorker cartoon, which shows a dog sitting at a computer keyboard. Sitting beside him on the floor is another dog. The dog, tapping away at the computer, looks down at his friend and says, "Once you're on the internet, they don't know you're a dog." It's a funny story, but it makes a serious point. The internet is often an anonymous medium. We need to test the credibility of those who tell us things on it and test the veracity and the tastefulness of what they say. I just want to reiterate what I said earlier in these remarks. Across the country, thousands of journalists are working honorably at their profession, striving to be fair, striving to be responsible, striving to bring rounded perspective to the news, often under deadline stress. But the errors of others are used by critics to impugn them all. Even in these recent weeks, as the press has been wrestling with the White House story, there's been a string of other journalistic embarrassments. CNN and Time magazine, two great journalistic organizations, carried a story that American forces on a secret mission in Laos in 1970 used lethal nerve gas to kill American defectors. The story proved untrue. After a public outcry and an internal investigation, the news organizations disavowed the story and apologized abjectly. The New Republic magazine was obliged to fire one of its editors for inventing characters, organizations, and dialogue in a string of stories he'd written. The Boston Globe had to force the resignation of one of its columnists for fabricating characters and quotes, and then shortly after that, get rid of another one for the same reason. The Cincinnati Inquirer had to publish a front-page apology and pay a hefty settlement for mistakes in the way its staff handled a series on the Chiquita Banana Company. If we look for the cause of these transgressions, we see that they were caused by inventing, or manipulating, or overstating, or misinterpreting the facts. Why are they happening? I think in large part because of the intense new competition between media organizations. Hundreds of new cable channels are competing among themselves and challenging the traditional networks. A crop of TV news magazines is in fierce combat for audience supremacy. Print newspapers are competing for readers against supermarket tabloids, weeklies, and throwaway freebies. The internet proliferates. Talk radio jousts with everybody. This, in turn, has generated an excess of ambitious zeal among competing reporters who work for competing entities. Some skate over the need to get the story right as they strive to get it first and make it flashy and confrontational. As commentator Jonathan Alter wrote in Newsweek magazine, the rewards in this business favor cleverness and attitude over the substance of policy issues. Well, I've discussed with you today some of the negative trends I perceive in a profession that I hold very dear. It's a profession which in this information age is going to be inevitably intertwined with your careers and your home lives. You need to be alert to its strengths, its promise, and also its weaknesses. I've given you the bad news. Now for the good news. The outlook is not all bleak. For one thing, the alarm bells are ringing in newsrooms, at newspapers, and in television stations around the country. There's considerable concern about journalistic lapses and the effect they're having on journalistic credibility. In seminars at journalism schools and through back and forth in professional journals, journalistic standards are being criticized and reassessed. Thoughtful men and women in journalism are pondering what can be done to improve the situation. Television news in particular has been notoriously unable or unwilling to make on-air corrections. Once during my time as a State Department spokesman, a nationally known correspondent reported on the evening news that the United States government was soon about to undertake an aggressive military operation in a Central American country. It's very difficult to get through to a network correspondent when the program is live and ongoing. But a few minutes after the broadcast ended, I got through and I told him I was on top of that story and there was no truth whatsoever to it. "Oh my gosh," he said, "that's terrible. But what can I do? The broadcast's over." The next night I waited for a correction or a retraction. It never came. An audience of millions was left with an uncorrected, inaccurate report that their government was about to conduct a military operation it had in fact never contemplated and, of course, never undertook. Today, some executives in the TV networks are groping for mechanisms that would permit viewers to air their complaints or to rebut perceived misstatements and inaccurate reporting. Some news organizations are practicing greater restraint before they publish. Newsweek magazine held back a major exclusive on the Lewinsky affair because they felt they didn't have it right. We've had a few instances where television anchors have declined to read bulletins thrust in front of them on air because they just weren't confident of the accuracy of those first reports. The role of the internet as a reliable news source is being questioned. And if all this adds up to a wake-up call for the media and leads to better self-policing, that's good. Now, what part can you as individuals play? For a start, there are 1,200 students at this university either pre-majoring or majoring in communications. They come from a university with a unique spirit. When they join the workforce, they have the capacity to make a formidable contribution, not only professionally, but morally. One of the things I most admired when I taught journalism students here was their concern about ethics. The question I was sometimes asked was whether students raised in a religious culture are tough enough to make it in journalism. And that question bemused me, because if journalism needs some reforming, who better to play a role in this reforming process than journalists steeped in a culture where ethics and morality are accorded high priority? Asserting your principles and maintaining your standards doesn't mean being obnoxious in journalism or in any other profession. You don't have to be abrasive to be a good journalist. When you leave this university, you may be confronted by colleagues whose concept of ethics may not parallel your own. That will be a test of your toughness of character and your beliefs. Ultimately, you may have to decide whether to stay in that environment in hopes of improving it or resign. When I was a young journalist, I worked for a news agency in London that relied for its existence on selling breaking news stories to the major metropolitan dailies. The hours were long, the atmosphere was highly competitive. The news editor, though professionally able, expressed many of the worst qualities you could possibly find in a human being. He preyed on the women, he humiliated the men. The newsroom was a place of fear and misery. And so I asked myself, what in the world am I doing here? And as I pondered that question, I determined that I would stay and try to improve the atmosphere. I thought about the God-given qualities required to produce good journalism. Some of them are honesty, accuracy, persistence, innovation, energy, endurance, compassion, imagination. And I did my best to inject them into the operations of the news agency. Things got better. I respected the news editor's professional competence. He respected my principles. Well, I can't tell you that he became angelic. As a matter of fact, in the end, he got fired and I got his job. But the whole situation did turn around. Now, I used that description of these qualities as God-given advisedly. There's no reason why religious belief should not be as effective in the workplace as it is in the home. Just a few days ago, I read a dispatch from the Knight Ridder News Service which discussed an industry trend favoring the expression of spirituality at work. The owner of a chemical manufacturing company, for instance, told the news service that providing a spiritual foundation can help employees who are constantly faced with contradictions and dilemmas in the workplace. A dash of humility doesn't hurt either. I began my journalistic career in South Africa and continued it in Britain and came to the United States as a young man. I'd been in the business for 6 or 7 years and I thought I knew my way around. I'd been a reporter and a bureau chief in a state capital. I wanted to work for the Boston-based Christian Science Monitor, a respected newspaper owned by a church. The editor told me gently that the only job he had vacant was that of a copy boy. I gulped, but I took it. And I can tell you that my humility was severely tested when a secretary asked me to wash out a glue pot and refill it. But I swallowed my pride and determined to polish those glue pots as they'd never been polished before. At night and on weekends, I wrote news stories and features that got into the paper, and pretty soon I was a reporter again, no longer cleaning glue pots. And within a year, the paper sent me to Africa as a foreign correspondent. Many years later, when I became editor of that paper, another young journalist came to me and asked for a job. He had a wife, 2 children, and a master's degree in Chinese studies. In what seemed to me an eerily familiar replay of my own early experience, I told him all I had was a copy boy's job, that he couldn't live on the salary, and he shouldn't take it. Well, he did. And while he was doing what might seem menial work, he wrote his way into the paper. We promoted him and made him editor of the News in Brief page, and he did that well. So we sent him to our one-person bureau in San Francisco, a most beautiful city that does not usually produce a lot of dramatic news. But soon after he got there, the Patty Hearst kidnapping story broke. And he covered that not as a cops and robbers story, but with a depth and a perception of the forces in play that made for superb journalism. So we made him our Hong Kong bureau chief. And later he went on to China and a continuing successful career as a foreign correspondent. To me, one of the most important qualities of all in journalism, as in life, is integrity. I'm troubled by the ambivalent public reaction to our current crisis in the White House. The polls seem to indicate a belief by some Americans that untrustworthiness and immorality do not have a bearing upon competence. This compartmentalization of ethics and morality on the one hand from professional ability on the other has no place in journalism. I don't think it does in public life, or for that matter, in any other walk of life. As I mentioned earlier during the administration of President Reagan, I took a diversion from journalism for several years to serve in a number of government posts. As State Department spokesman, I worked for Secretary of State George Shultz, a man of quiet but impressive integrity. Often he would discuss with three or four of his aides some decision to be made in foreign policy. We would lay out the options, the risks, the gains. There would be talk of the political fallout, the press reaction, the international consequences. And then Secretary Shultz would often quietly say, "But what's the right thing to do?" It seems to me that's an approach based on integrity that's fitting for any line of endeavor. Discerning the difference between right and wrong is really not so difficult in any phase of life. It's choosing between right and wrong that sometimes gives us problems. Making the right choice demands character. Well, many of you here today and many of you watching on television are not going to end up as practicing journalists. And so you may be saying, "So what can I do about all this?" But whether you go on from BYU to become a distinguished musician, or discover a cure for cancer, or become an elected politician, or a great engineer, you're going to be on the receiving end of a torrent of information that will guide many of the decisions you make in life. You must make intelligent judgments about what you read in newspapers, listen to on radio, and look at on television. I do believe that you have a responsibility as a citizen and as a product of this university to determine the truth about what is going on around you in your local community and the nation and the world. The entertainment industry has clearly gone beyond the boundaries of reasonable taste with its sordid song lyrics, movies with excessive violence and profanity, and television programs with sexually explicit material. When Hollywood offers up junk on grounds that that's what the public wants, we have the opportunity to show them that's not true. And we've had some rather interesting examples of that in Utah just recently. Well, now, by the same token, when some elements of the press offer up material that you think is inaccurate, distorted, or distasteful, there's similar opportunity for consumers to be heard. Editors listen. Each day, the Deseret News gets a flood of letters from readers on all kinds of subjects. We're much heartened by this citizen involvement in the affairs of the city, state, and nation. Sometimes readers don't agree with what we've reported or some position we've taken on our opinion page. I get faxes and email messages directly to me taking issue with something the newspaper has done. On most newspapers, editors are mindful of these comments. They don't always agree with the readers, but they heed their reaction to what the newspaper published. When mistakes are made, they correct them. So call or write your newspaper or television station when you think they've got it wrong. Tell them when you think they're neglecting something they should be covering or not putting something in proper perspective. Let them know that somebody is monitoring their performance and cares. The final sanction that a reader can exert against a newspaper or a viewer can exert a TV program that he or she thinks is doing a bad job is to stop reading it or turn the dial. The saving grace of the press in this remarkable society we call the United States is its incredible diversity. It ranges from the sleazy supermarket tabloids at one end of the spectrum to serious newspapers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal at the other. It ranges from so-called TV news magazines, which are really entertainment magazines, to the Jim Lehrer NewsHour on PBS and Ted Koppel on Nightline. No matter how complex the subject, somewhere in this extraordinary range, the inquiring mind will find the information it needs and can trust. Lest you are a little cynical about what I've just said, about your opportunity, and you're doubting the power of the individual to make a difference in society, let me leave you with a little story I heard while attending church with my wife a few Sundays ago. The speaker told of a visitor walking a long Florida beach when the tide was going out. The visitor observed a man coming from the opposite direction, bending over every few feet and throwing something back into the sea. He was throwing back starfish stranded on the sand high above the water. The puzzled visitor engaged the man in conversation. "Aren't there hundreds of starfish marooned on this beach?" she said. The man agreed. "Aren't there dozens of beaches along this coast with thousands and thousands of starfish stranded?" she persisted. Again, the man agreed. "Well then," said the visitor, "how can you possibly expect to make a difference?" The man smiled gently. He stooped down, picked up another starfish, and tossed it back into the ocean. As he resumed his walk along the beach, he called back over his shoulder, "It made a difference to that one." I thank you for your attention. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you again.